first case, People versus Burden. Council are seated at council table. I suppose that you're prepared and ready to go on that case. Okay, did you receive the oral argument, a set of oral argument instructions when you came in? Any questions? Okay. Second case is Carr versus ICAO. Council here and prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Tim Will for the petitioner. Yes, Your Honor.
You received the oral argument procedures? Any questions? Okay. With that, we can begin with the first case of People versus Burden.
Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497, ADC appointed counsel for Mr. Burden. The grounds for Mr. Burden's 35C that was filed by counsel was that his conviction was unconstitutionally obtained because he was incompetent to proceed at either the trial or represent himself at sentencing. And that was for both cases. First, we had the trial in the first case. And then immediately afterwards, there was the guilty plea in the second case, and then sentencing on both cases where he represented himself. I respectfully submit that this issue is not barred by the Court of Appeals' previous direct appeal, because that panel of the Court of Appeals only heard the narrow issue of whether on that record that was created prior to the trial by the public defender, whether the district court abused its discretion in finding or making a preliminary finding of competence. There was no request for a competency evaluation. There was no testimony by expert witnesses. There was no psychiatric evidence of any kind, just a preliminary finding of competence by that judge based on her observation of the defendant in the courtroom and some questions she asked him, and some testimony she heard ex parte from the defense counsel. But defense counsel never requested a competency evaluation after that. And one of the grounds for the 35C was that was ineffective assistance of counsel. I respectfully submit that the proof is in the pudding here, because when a competency evaluation was conducted 18 months later, Mr. Burden was in fact found to be incompetent both by the defense expert and by the Colorado Mental Health Institute on request of the judge. So the issue for the evidentiary hearing would have been, had we been allowed to have an evidentiary hearing, was whether Mr. Burden could have proven by a preponderance of the evidence that it was more likely than not that he was also incompetent 18 months prior, in June 2005, when we had the trial and then the guilty plea and then the sentencing hearing, because he was exhibiting the same bizarre and paranoid behavior in July 2005 that it was exhibiting 18 months later, that formed the basis for the incompetency findings by those two completely different set of mental health professionals.
Ms. Ruttenberg, what evidence is there in the record that Mr. Burden was incompetent at the time of these trials? I know you've just referred to an evaluation that occurred 18 months later, but what do we have in addition to what the trial court had and the Court of Appeals had on direct appeal relating to the competency at the time of the trials?
All of those writings of his that I attached to the 35C motion, where he's talking about this big, elaborate, and bizarre conspiracy against him. And it was that same conspiracy that the doctor down at the state hospital referred to when she found him incompetent to proceed because he was unable to cooperate with his counsel because he was having those paranoid delusions regarding that conspiracy regarding this man named Sal Barrio, who he thought was a district court judge that was somehow behind the scenes pulling everybody's strings. He was writing about that earlier, and I attached that to the 35C, and then that same type of conspiracy was what he was continuing to talk about when he went down to the state mental hospital, and that's what the doctor down at the state mental hospital found as the basis for him being incompetent to proceed because he could not cooperate with counsel.
Trutenberg, I have a question. Is there any legal authority that you know of that authorizes courts to look retroactively at competency to extrapolate someone's competency from a prior event?
Well, no, except for Dusky and all these other cases that say it's a due process violation for an incompetent defendant to be compelled to go to trial. I mean, naturally, what happens is if the argument is that of an incompetent defendant is compelled to go to trial, then later on, when we have the post-conviction hearing, necessarily we're going to have to try to make findings of facts and conclusions of law as to what his mental state likely was at the time of the trial. In a post-conviction proceeding, the burden of proof is only by a preponderance of the evidence. So all I would have to do at the evidentiary hearing through my expert witnesses is show that it was more likely than not that he was suffering from the same paranoid delusions that he was suffering with and creating the difficulty with his defense counsel prior to the trial. Given the fact that his trial defense counsel was having all of that difficulty with him is also evidence that he was suffering from the same types of paranoid delusions that he was 18 months later. And had he actually been sent down to the state hospital in June of 2005, I think I can prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they would have found him incompetent then. But I need the opportunity to have that evidentiary hearing, and under White versus District Court and the other authority I cited in my opening brief, I'm entitled to have that evidentiary hearing if I can set facts in my brief that entitled me to that hearing.
Counsel, at the time of the trial court made a preliminary determination that the defendant was competent. Wouldn't your position, if taken to the extreme, necessitate a full competency evaluation every time an issue of competency is raised? Otherwise, it's subject to relitigation in a post-conviction relief motion?
Well, in this case, we have a couple of unique factors.
Is that a no or a yes to the question?
Well, the issue is whether it was ineffective assistance of counsel in this case to fail to request a competency evaluation at that time after the court made the preliminary finding of competency, which under the statutes that were in effect at that time was the next step he was supposed to take. And the unique issue in this case is that later on down the road, which has never happened in any other case I've ever seen, the defendant was found to be incompetent by the state mental hospital. 18 months isn't that long of a period of time, and the expert witnesses I would put on at the evidentiary hearing would testify regarding it's very unlikely for someone to have that level of a schizophrenic break or psychiatric decomposition in only 18 months' time. So under the unique facts of this case, which was that the defendant was exhibiting this bizarre behavior prior to trial, but there was no psychiatric testimony before the district court, the defense counsel had the opportunity to request a competency evaluation and failed to do so, whether that was ineffective assistance of counsel, given all of these other factors regarding this defendant.
Trenberg, along those lines, what information do you contend trial counsel had or could have obtained at the time of trial that was not presented to the district court? I mean, you refer again to things that happened 18 months and several years later. But what was known to counsel at the time that made representation ineffective?
That the defendant was acting so bizarrely that he couldn't cooperate with trial counsel, and trial counsel made a record regarding that, which is why trial counsel should have then requested a competency evaluation, because again, the judge made her preliminary determination of competency on the fact that the defendant told her, I promise to behave in a courtroom, I'm not going to engage in any outbursts. And the court did what a lot of district courts do. They say, well, look, the defendant is oriented as to time and space. He knows what's going on. He knows I'm a judge. He knows that's a jury. He knows this is a courtroom. He knows what the charges are. Therefore, he's competent. But that's not the test for competency. That's only the first half of the test for competency. Under the Mondragon case and the Tenth Circuit Lafferty case, a defendant can still be incompetent if going to trial or cooperating with the trial process is consistent with his delusions, which is what happened to Ronald Lafferty, and that's exactly what was going on with this defendant. He thought, you know, part of his paranoid delusions were this Sal Barrio character had seated the jury, had paid off the DA, or that the DA was secretly Sal Barrio's daughter or the twin sister of the FBI agent that was his daughter or whatever. So, sometimes some of the different factors in his various writings regarding this conspiracy against him change. But so you would expect somebody like that to want to go to trial and to cooperate with the trial process because he thought that the whole trial was a kangaroo court because Sal Barrio had seated the jury. But that doesn't make him competent. Still, he was incompetent because he was operating under those paranoid delusions that Sal Barrio had seated the jury, that Sal Barrio had engendered this giant conspiracy, and that going to trial was consistent with that. And while trial defense counsel might not have been aware of that, he had enough information that he should have requested a competency evaluation so that he could establish whether the defendant was suffering from a mental illness such as paranoid schizophrenia that was causing him to have these difficulties cooperating with counsel.
He could have requested one, but the trial court wasn't obligated to conduct one. Isn't that right?
Well, had the trial court not granted the competency evaluation at that point, then the whole structure of the appeal would have been different. We would have had different issues on appeal, not just whether this really narrow issue is whether she abused her discretion as to making the preliminary finding of competency. So again, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel looks at the entire case, and you know, there's two issues here, not just ineffective assistance of counsel, but whether the defendant was in fact incompetent to proceed in 2005. I would really like to reserve the rest of my time if there are no further questions right now.
May it please the court and counsel, Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the appellate division 19210 here for the people. Our argument is very simple, that this was an issue that was raised at trial and addressed on direct appeal. It's either the same or a very closely allied issue here that was addressed. And under rules of criminal procedure and under case law, the defendant cannot re-raise the claim here, and therefore the trial court properly summarily denied this without granting the defendant a hearing. Competency doesn't mean that you don't have any competence to proceed, as the Supreme Court said, is just a modest aim. It doesn't mean you don't have problems. It doesn't mean that a formal evaluation is necessary. All it means is the defendant has an ability to cooperate with counsel and understand the nature of the proceedings for him. The trial court looked into this at trial. Defense counsel raised the issue below. Trial court questioned counsel and the defendant, and the trial court, based on firsthand knowledge, was able to make, I think, a superior judgment as far as whether the defendant was then capable at the time of trial of acting competently at this trial. There is case law, fairly recent case law, I think, that talks about retrospective competency evaluations. I wrote on it last month. I can't even remember the name of the brief I wrote last month concerning it. Retrospective will find it in competency in the same paragraph. They are disfavored, and they are hard to perform because you're trying to look back in time. A trial judge looking at a defendant at the time of trial is in a superior position to determine if the defendant has the necessary degree of understanding of what is going on at trial. People trying to recreate what the defendant was going through 18 months later are in a very poor position. So not only do we have the same issue addressed earlier, but we have it addressed in a much better way, a much more reliable manner.
Mr. Kaler, I have a question about that. So essentially, it may be disfavored, but it is legally cognizable to be able to determine retrospectively a defendant's competence.
Sure.
And I had a second question for you. So if you are stating that the issue has already been raised and therefore would be barred for a review, could an attorney ever be ineffective for failing to ask for a further competency evaluation after a preliminary finding of competent?
I don't think so. Not if counsel raised it at the time of trial and gave the trial court an opportunity to investigate right then and there. I don't think counsel could be ineffective for raising it at the appropriate time so that the trial court could make the appropriate findings.
What if counsel had other information that she did not disclose to the trial court at the time?
Oh, I guess that's theoretically possible, Your Honor. But I guess it's theoretically possible.
Does the record in this case indicate whether or not counsel had, or the allegations indicate counsel had any information that had been undisclosed to the trial court at the time?
I can't remember that at all, Your Honor. Still, even if there is other evidence out there, the question is, for a trial court dealing with a competency question, is the defendant then understanding what's going on before that particular tribunal at that time? Is the defendant then capable to communicate with his counsel and with the rational degree of understanding? Even if there is other information, that is the issue that is before the trial court, and that is, the trial court is in the superior position to make that evaluation.
The trial court is, but if the trial court is not told, for instance, if counsel has information that, gee, there's a fictitious guy named Sal Boreal who's already fixed the jury for the defendant, so the defendant doesn't have to worry about things, don't you think that might have affected the way the trial court might look at whether or not the defendant is able to assist his counsel with an unfixed jury?
I guess that's possible, Your Honor.
I have another follow-up question on that, because I've seen cases with ineffective assistance claims based on an attorney's failure to investigate. Could that be applicable here for an attorney's failure to investigate further information regarding competence?
I guess that's what the defendant's claim is, if they'd filed a written motion and gotten a written evaluation. An evaluation could have been done at the state hospital. But again, the question is, did the counsel raise the question here? Did the trial court investigate what was going on? And the trial court conducted an appropriate investigation as to the defendant's capacity or competency at the time of trial, and that's sufficient. I have nothing further to say, unless the court would like to ask me more questions about that or about the proportionality claim. Thank you very much.
Counsel stated several times that the court is in a superior position to judge competency. I would respectfully submit that she is not competent to make that determination because she is a JD, not an MD, and only a psychiatrist or a psychologist can determine whether a defendant is suffering from a mental illness and whether that mental illness is impacting his ability to effectively communicate with counsel. And that specifically is the issue that defense counsel did not raise as a follow-up issue.
So you're saying that only a doctor is capable of expressing an opinion or making a determination about legal competence?
Legal competence necessarily includes whether or not the defendant is suffering from a mental illness, and that is not something that either a lawyer or a judge can do. Once there is a credible issue as to whether the defendant is mentally ill and his mental illness is impacting his ability to cooperate with counsel or understand the proceedings, then only an MD or a psychologist is able to come in and say whether the defendant is actually mentally ill or not.
Wait a second. Go ahead. Let's assume the defendant is mentally ill, but it's not affecting his ability to either understand the proceedings or cooperate with counsel. Is that a MD determination or a judge determination?
if the issue is never raised because the defendant is able to cooperate with the court and counsel, then a psychiatrist need not come in. But once the issue is raised and there's credible evidence that the defendant is suffering bizarre behavior that's consistent with mental illness, I don't know any lawyer or judge that is competent per se to make a diagnosis as to whether somebody actually is mentally ill. I mean, certainly can make observations, and we can make some ad hoc conclusions based on our prior experiences dealing with the mentally ill. Certainly everybody in the criminal defense community has experience dealing with the mentally ill. But that's one issue. And then the second issue is that counsel in this case failed to object when the judge said, well, I'm making my preliminary determination of competency based on his promise to cooperate in the courtroom and that he seems to be well-oriented as to time and place. At that point, it was ineffective for counsel to say, well, wait a minute, he's unable to cooperate with me, which was the entire issue here. And that would have provided a basis to send him down to the state mental hospital in order to have evaluation to see whether his lack of ability to cooperate with counsel was due to mental illness or just because he was being irascible and difficult, which is also something criminal defendants tend to do. But if they do that as a result of mental illness and they're unable to cooperate with their counsel, then that raises a serious competency issue, which lawyers and judges do not have the training and the expertise to be able to determine.
So that sounds like an argument, though, that the district court simply abused its discretion in making a preliminary finding of competence, and that's already been decided, hasn't it?
No, the district court based on the evidence it had before it, the conclusion that the district court reached, that based on this information, I'm making this preliminary determination of competence that he can cooperate in the courtroom. The Court of Appeals said no. Based on that information before that court and based on the lack of objection by defense counsel saying no, you didn't use the entire test when you made that determination, that didn't abuse her discretion. But now we've got a much broader issue that is going to require psychiatric and other medical evidence at an evidentiary hearing for the 35C. If there's no further questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.